Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
X is also the symbol that should have been prodigiously used to cross out the script's many, many, many stupid ideas. Johnny Oleksinski of the New York Post, former guest here on Cinephiles, a great film critic. I always enjoy his work. Not crazy about his newspaper. But that's talking about Godzilla X Kong, the new Empire. That's our featured review this week. As far as our old movie this week, it's Steven Spielberg's favorite movie. I don't know if that's confirmed. I've seen that on IMDb. I've seen it elsewhere. I believe it is. It's Akira Kurosawa's Akira. I'm doing that movie with a heavy heart for my dear friend, Glenn McDonald. As far as our wild card this week, Laura Brandt, in her final act as guest booker of Metal Arc, gave us not just one author, but two. You know, you knew she was going to empty the tank. So we have two authors, two great guys, Alan Silver and James Ursini, and they're talking about the book all about Double Indemnity. From the moment they met, it was murder, the story of Double Indemnity. It's available in bookstores right now. So make sure you go check it out. Those guys are great. TCM approved. I'm sure Mankiewicz is all in. And I really enjoyed their time as I rewatched Double Indemnity as well. I want to begin, though, because I reminded myself a couple weeks ago, Cody had put in the headline, Lunch with Levitard. And I realized I didn't give any details about that lunch. So let me just tell you this snippet, which you'll appreciate. Lunch was great. Cracking jokes, you know, just kibitzing. And when Levitard went to the bathroom, I said, here's my opening. So I called the waiter over, and him and Dan were only speaking Spanish the whole time. And I call him over, and I was like, hey, can I get the check? And he's like, kind of gives like a no. And I'm like, I know, check. I need the check now. Like, he's in the bathroom. He's like a no bueno. And I'm like, hey, no. And he's like, Senor. And I think he said Senor Levitard. I go, I don't give a crap who Senor Levitard is. Like, I'm somebody important where I come from, okay? Like, I'm Mr. North Jersey. So you give me the check. His money's no good here. I'm taking care of this. You give me that bill right now. And he's like, he gives one more kind of note. And I go, bring it now. Firmly. Goes, okay. As Dan walks out, he laughs and goes, oh, my lucky day. And I'm like, got him. I got it. No problem. He's like, even there's one slight issue. I go, no, there's no issue. I got it. He's like, okay. And a few minutes later, the guy gives a bag to Dan. Dan goes, this was the issue I was going to say to you. He's like, what?
He ordered something for his wife.
Right. Like, you order stuff for Valerie? No problem. I'm happy to take care of the tacos and guac there. He's like, no, actually, this is like 25 martinis, which is for tomorrow's Oscar party. And I was like, oh, make sure you tell the crew. So nobody said thank you to me. I want you to at least know. You go tell Smetana. Hey, by the way, those margaritas, courtesy of Adnamber.
What did it run you?
Great questions. Because I didn't even look. By the way, let's go back to your point about tipping also the other day. You mentioned valet tipping. I'll get to that in a second. I just quickly hit 20%. I didn't even look at the number. So I just went 20%.
Let me guess. It's food. Did you eat? You were fasting at that time?
So no, at that time I was not. It was right before I went on.
Okay.
Study.
So you ate.
I had a salad, taco salad. Dan just trips and guac. He had one drink. I just had water. Okay. So that bill was probably very meager.
That bill would have been like, even in Miami, South Beck, that bill right there is probably $45 right there.
Yeah, that's probably right.
And then the margs, I'm thinking, how many you said?
I don't know how many it was. It was like a bag of margaritas.
I'm thinking that was like $200.
Yeah. So like, you're very good. Two bill was like $252, $262, yeah. I guess. All right, yeah. Well.
I know my overpriced Miami.
Exactly. And I'm like, not that anybody would have known that I would have paid, but I just wish somebody now looking back on that Oscar had said, man, these margaritas are fire. I'm like, okay. Then I know we got our money's worth.
And this week on Levitard, you're getting your shout out.
It's all I care about. I just want to get my credit. Other than that, lunch was great. The funniest part then, Dan goes, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm meeting Ben Lyons and his lady for dinner later tonight. But I actually want to go to the beach. And Dan goes, well, you're on the beach. He goes, matter of fact, if you're parked, he goes, I would just stay where you're parked. And I said, well, the parking, he goes, whatever it is, it's better than where you're going. Trust me, where you're going to go, there's no parking. It's $100. So just if it's $8 an hour, pay the $50 and you're good. I would hop in an Uber. And then he paused and corrected himself and said, no, but you like to walk. And I'm like, yeah, good memory. He's like, you like to walk. So he goes, you know what? I'm going to drop you off on a street. I think it was called Lincoln. He goes, you're going to walk down there 30 minutes and it's a nice little walk. You'll enjoy your walk. You'll get to the beach. I'm like, Thank you very much. Thank you for remembering I like a good walk. So I did not cross any major highways this time. I did enjoy Miami in all of its splendor. But lunch with Levitard is a good time. And I encourage others to be able to do so as well. Speaking of the Levitard universe, I also retweeted the article by Barrett Sports Media. If anybody has a chance, make sure you go check it out. I will look up quickly who the author was. But BSM is as it's commonly known. Fantastic article just about Chris and obviously Stu and Dan. The best part of it was Stu, because Stu was the one who tweeted about it and goes, this guy spent more time on the show than I do. And he specifically brought to Stu Gatz's attention that when he's not there, it's a Dan Levitard show without Stu Gatz.
Yeah.
And the quote is so Stu Gatz. And he's like, really? They do that when I'm not there? He goes, that's hysterical. That's a great idea. I wish I had that idea. That's fantastic. They're doing that. I had no idea. That shows you how little I pay attention to the show and I'm not there.
That is, Stu Gatz is the king of that. With that guy in particular, he's like, he's doing a day in the life of Levitard show and Stu Gatz is not there. It's like the perfect, it's like a chef's kiss of what it should be.
But I liked your quotes when you said, listen, when ESPN let me go, everyone's like, they blame me for the fact we're no longer the ESPN. But I would say that was the exclamation point. It wasn't like it was a happy marriage and all of a sudden, oh, they got rid of Cody. It was like, eh, there's already some issues. And this was the
mommy and daddy were fighting a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
As a kid in that household, just so you know, it wasn't all peaches before that.
Correct. That was the final adulterous affair, which led to the divorce. Anyways, check out that article. It's really funny. It's really well written. I also want to mention, before we get into the movie reviews, Back to Black, which is the trailer for the new Amy Winehouse movie. I haven't had a chance to dive in just yet, but I'm very curious, always curious when it comes to Amy Winehouse. Like, are you going to get a major actress doing it, like Reese Witherspoon playing June Carter Cash in Walk the Line that wins an Academy Award, Joaquin Phoenix playing Johnny Cash, or somebody who's a relative unknown? So in this instance, somebody asked me the other day what I think about Back to Black, and I said, well, I haven't seen the movie yet. I look forward to seeing it at some point. My wife, a big Amy Winehouse fan, of course, who doesn't love Rehab, great track, but I don't know the lead actress, which I think in this case is probably for the best, because again, if it was somebody I knew, you're like, oh, then you're picturing that person doing it the entire time. So it's Marissa Abella, whose work I'm not familiar with. She is playing Amy Winehouse. When I think of Amy Winehouse though and movies, I always think of the scary movies. I don't know who it was, whoever played Amy Winehouse in like the Beehive or the Teen thing. So I mean, they should have just got that chick to do it, but we'll see. British movie, May 17th coming out. I look forward to Back to Black musical biopics. Go ahead.
I heard another news about a biopic, Bruce Springsteen, Jeremy Allen White.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. So, and that is so great because you see the side-by-side. I've read that book. Michael Lombardi, my old buddy from a GM Shuffle, who's been on, I believe, God Bless Football a couple of times. He called me randomly. He was like, hey, you got to read this Bruce book. And I'm like, okay. He's like, I'm getting your address. I go, I'll go get it, Mike. He's like, no, I'm sending it to you right now. I'm on Amazon. Give me your address. I'm like, all right. And it's called Deliver Me From Nowhere. And it's an excellent book. It's written by Warren Zanes, who wrote a great book on Tom Petty as well. And apparently he's a decent musician as well. The book came out back in May 2nd. So I'd encourage, if you're a big Springsteen fan, to read it. It's not about his whole life. It's just about specifically the making of Springsteen's Nebraska, which is an album which is very stripped down, acoustic. It's not personally my favorite. I'm more of a, Dancing in the Dark, Born in the USA kind of guy, which was right after that. But Nebraska certainly has its fans. And it really is a great album when you look back at it start to finish. Atlantic City, obviously a great track. Anyways, to your point, that tweet comes out and it says it's specifically, I think, based on this book. So it's not only Jeremy Allen White playing Bruce, but he's playing Bruce from that time, which is early 80s. I think he's probably in his late 30s. So, and like, he's got that big hair. When I see the side-by-side, I'm like, man, we might be able to be pretty good Springsteen.
Like, it looks like it works.
Like in my head, I'm like, he can't play Bruce. Who the hell is going to play Bruce Springsteen? The boss. But that guy's such a good actor. I look forward to seeing it. So you're right. That's going to be cool to see Deliver Me From Nowhere, the movie version of that with Jeremy Allen White, who's definitely having a moment right now. That guy's an eighth star. Quick thought, Lou Gossett Jr. passed away. Somebody tweeted me, you're going to talk about that. I don't have a lot to say, except he was a good actor, and particularly An Officer and a Gentleman, which is a great film. You should definitely check that out. I saw Ben Mankiewicz did an appreciation for him, I believe, on TCM. So if you're a big Louis Gossett Jr. fan, go check that out. Officer and Gentleman came back way back in 1982. He played Sergeant Emil Foley, also Richard Gere, that movie. Taylor Hackford directed, Deborah Winger. Lou Gossett, RIP. All right, let's get to the movies. So we continued our trek of the local theaters. By the way, thank you to everybody who listened last week, told me I believe I should get AMC A-List. I think that's $21 a month and you can see up to 3 movies a week, which is insane. I mean,
that's just for you though, right? That wouldn't be your kids too.
And that's an excellent point. And that was by the way, right on cue. You got to see this. Look who's calling me right now. We will edit this out after. I don't know if you can see it.
Well, hello there, Adnan. I'd like to talk to you. It's John Skipper.
We'll just decline that call. That's fine. We'll get back to John.
Power move right there.
Yeah, exactly. But Yes, the whole issue is the add-ons, because I'm like, but if I'm bringing my kids, you know, that's going to be the issue. This is so bizarre. Like, I can actually see the voicemail, which is being sent to me. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen this before. Someone leaves a call, and then the script is coming up as to what the voicemail is. I've never seen that before. That's so bizarre. Normally it just says, like, if you call me, Chris Cody missed call,
you don't
Cody
see
voicemail.
It in the act. You don't see it in the act, like, of the message being transcribed.
Maybe this is exactly. Let me know right now. Have you had a transcribed voicemail recently, or is my phone just going rogue right now?
Because when you go to voicemails, you see a transcription sometimes, but this was happening in real time. Like, as he's saying, like, hello, Adnan, I'm sorry I missed you.
It's both accurate and unnerving. Back to Chris's point, which is the correct one. What about kids? Because everyone's like, oh, $21, you can see all you want. I'm like, yeah, but it's not everything I want, because I'm going to see Godzilla X Kong and I'm paying for three other tickets. Am I getting a discount on those? Probably not. So I still want to support local theaters. So I went to another local theater, and I got to tell you, no slushies, kids already bummed. No reclining seats, dad's bummed. One thing I did like was no trailers. 1:15 movie, we probably got there 1:18, 1:19. She goes, oh, the movie just started. I go, it just started? She's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, there's no 15, 20 minutes of trailers? She goes, no, we're not messing around. I go, wow, okay, let's run in there. Okay, Kong's already getting after it. Okay, fine. Sorry, our bad.
Man, when you walk up to that slushy machine and you see that red light, there's just nothing worse.
Nothing worse. Like, you're hoping the red light is saying, yes, we're open for business. But no, it's saying not in use.
And I like the Coca-Cola flavored slushy. That's my preferred one. But like, so when like the only one working is like the blue one, it's like, I don't want my whole mouth being blue. No. Like, I'm not a child. I'm not six.
Generally, given a choice, blue and red mixed. Okay. But you would go straight
I'm a Coca-Cola. And if I'm going to mix, I'll go cherry. I'll go red with some Coca-Cola.
Okay, so Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is the mainstay. That's what we learned from today.
It's my cheat day. A little Coca-Cola.
But it was annoying because I brought one of my kids' friends and he wanted an orange juice. And I met him like, you're not going to like this kid. Like, it's just a regular straight up orange juice. It's not like a special Tropicana orange juice. And he's renowned for wasting stuff. I looked over at one point, like, you know, three sips. And of course, I'm fasting, so I can't drink any of it. So I'm like, man, I'm doubly annoyed. A, I can't finish that. B, you wasted that drink, kid. That was a $4 orange juice over there. Thankfully, my kid guzzling his Pepsi. I'm like, yeah, you go get it, pal.
You taught him
slurp
right.
Away.
You taught him
That's
right.
That's what I want to hear. Exactly. As for Godzilla X Kong, so the first part of it is this. Before it was Godzilla versus Kong. They were adversaries. Now they're boys. Now it's Godzilla X Kong.
Now so it's a multiplication problem.
It's a multiplication issue. Yeah. That's the other thing, too. I believe Johnny Oleksensky put that in his review. Like, I don't even know how to pronounce Godzilla X Kong, the new empire. What the hell it is? I'm like,
Times
is
Kong?
It Times Kong? Yeah, is it X Kong? Like, I go in X Kong, but I think it's Times Kong because it's more Godzillas. It's more Kongs. So they're no longer adversaries. Multiplied by Godzilla Kong. All the Kong, Godzilla squared, Kong squared, all you can handle. And the story is just, I don't even know if it matters at this point. Like, I think anybody going to see this movie is like, I couldn't care less about the story. And yet, for some reason, I feel like I should discuss the story just at least a little bit. So they're in a different area. Like, it's the Hidden Empire. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, I'm using the Hollow Earth. Excuse me. Yeah. So they're in Hollow Earth. By the way, this is what I was shocked by. The 38th film of the Godzilla franchise and the 13th film in the King Kong franchise.
Wow.
Like, you and I know some weird people. We know people who, like, you know, they watch every Lord of the Rings or they watch every Star Wars. Like, could you imagine being the guy who's like, oh, I love monster movies. I've seen all 38 films of the Godzilla franchise and all 13 King Kongs.
That's an odd person. For sure.
You got to watch the Final Four. You got to watch something else with your life, man. Like, Purdue, UConn.
Like Ben Lyons. I like sports. Okay.
When I said to Boo, did you read the Dune book? He's like, no, I like sports growing up. Like, yeah, that's the answer we're looking for. The film stars Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, etc. A few of them are reprising their roles from previously, but King encounters more of his species in the Hollow Earth. So this to me is to unite with Godzilla to stop their tyrannical leader and a powerful frost-breathing titan from destroying the surface. So they're buddies now, but there's this evil Kong who's just like, forget about it. Like, that Kong you don't want to mess with. They have flashbacks to Skull Island, also the Arctic, where things happen there. But ultimately, the plot is just an excuse to have the monsters get after it. Let's be honest. Of the two, I got to be honest, Cody, I think it's not even close. If you told me Godzilla versus Kong, and I know it's not, it's X, but I'm taking Kong every day of the week. Like, Godzilla is just a giant lizard who at this point is like pink at one point, and there's this one lizard when he breathes, rather than fire, he turns him into ice. But I'm all about Kong. Like, as you know, going back to one of the first pods we did with Ron McGill, I'm a huge gorilla guy, as are my kids. Anything involving a gorilla, I'm in favor of. Ron McGill told the story. Go back and listen. He was like face to face with the gorilla. As Chris said, you must have been shitting your pants. Miguel was calm, though. He said, no, they're primates. They're friendly. They like plants. Regardless, seeing Kong on the big screen is always a treat for me. I just think And again, I can't be more clearer than this. I understand nobody watching this movie cares about the plot, but even by the essence of what a blockbuster plot is, this was pretty lame. And at one point, I kept saying to myself, why do I care? Like, and what's even more upsetting is like when you see good actors, like Brian Tyree Henry, this guy was nominated for an Academy Award. He was in that film with Jennifer Lawrence. Like it was called Causeway. He was in Atlanta, Donald Glover. Like, and I get it. I'm not passing judgment. I'm just like, dude, you're such a good actor. I'm like, I guess they threw a bunch of money at you. You want to be in Godzilla, X-Kong? I'm not judging. But I'm like, it's just talent wasted. When I'm watching this movie, I'm like, man, Brian Tyree Henry's just wasting his talent in this movie. Rebecca Hall wasting her talent. Let's just get to the monsters. And I'll say this, even when the monsters go at it, you think, okay, fine, the plot's stupid. You know, the characters stink. It's not very funny. The dialogue's uninteresting. All that. Okay, fine. But as long as the monsters deliver, even then, it's so much CGI. it makes me think, like, it's also cartoonish. You know what I mean? Like, there's one scene, Godzilla gets so upset, he, like, takes a nap in the Rome Coliseum. And I'm like, okay, at least, like, I know what the Coliseum is. I've been there. Like, other times in Hollow Earth, like, it's just these bizarre, shapeless places. And I'm like, I couldn't get over the feeling of, like, why do I care? And when is this going to end? Those are the two biggest issues I had with it. I'm giving it 1.5 Maple Leafs. Maybe if you're a big Godzilla X Kong fan, maybe you want to see all 38 versions of Godzilla, 13 of Kong. I get it. But I'm telling you, I go to this movie, I'm not expecting a lot. I'm just expecting some thrills and chills. I don't even get that. Even the action scenes themselves are too much CGI. And it was a frustrating experience overall, especially for $44 and the orange juices. But I'll give it 1.5 Maple Leafs. Like I said, I wouldn't recommend it. It also makes me think about, by the way, I read another review that talked about all the actors who've been in these movies. Like, Bryan Cranston was in a Godzilla movie. Like, it's crazy the amount of wasted talent we've seen. Vera Farmiga as well. I'd say one fight that was pretty good was in Cairo in Egypt. So you see the pyramids, you see everybody. I'm like, okay, again, that gives it a sense of realism. You know, the Scar King is the guy they're trying to destroy. I mean, he's just a badass. He's not a gorilla I would like to mess with. They try to also add in, like, this father-son stuff. Like, there's a little baby orangutan that Godzilla's, like, Kong's looking after. And I'm like, you know what? We don't need the baby orangutan.
Would you rather have someone like Cranston do an animated role for a paycheck or this kind of role for a paycheck?
Animated role for a paycheck. If it's Kung Fu Panda form, like, you know, it's fine. I love his voice. He's doing it. Like, he's doing promos for Major League Baseball. Now, he genuinely loves baseball, loves the Dodgers, but I'm like, I'm sure the check doesn't hurt either. So I'm like, yeah. He was the PA announcer for the Dodgers home opener. I'm like, yeah, Cranston's just there because he loves baseball.
Was he?
Yeah. You have to look it up. The Dodgers home opener, he was the public address announcer, and he was fantastic. I don't know who the regular guy is, but he was like, Mookie Betts. I'm like, yeah,
that's awesome.
Coming out for, like, center field. Josh Groban sang the anthem. Like, it's cool when these guys are legitimately into it, which he clearly is, super fan. Anyways, Godzilla X Kong, the new empire. I wasn't crazy about it, unless you really like your monsters. And the one thing I kept thinking to myself is one of the rare movies that I was not sent the screener towards was the Godzilla movie that came out last year. That was the one that, speaking of Spielberg, right? That was, people were saying, have you seen Godzilla Minus One? I said, I had not received the screener for it. And they said, that's actually one of the best monster movies of recent vintage. And I saw more than a couple of reviews that said, hey, if you've seen Godzilla Minus One and then you go watch Godzilla X Kong New Empire, you're going to be even more annoyed, because Godzilla Minus One is a legitimately good horror thriller movie, has a plot, has a story, makes you feel things. And they go, it's even worse. So I can't imagine. My review was not strong. I can't imagine if I actually saw Godzilla Minus One, how much more upset I would be. I will see Godzilla Minus One whenever I find it streaming at some point. All right, we're going to get to our guests here in just a second. But first, I wanted to mention the movie Akira. So the reason why we're doing this here is I want to talk to my buddy Glennie Mack. So when I worked at the Score Television Network way back when, early in my career, Glennie Mack is one of these guys, senior producer. He's the nicest guy to the new people in the room. And I'm like, I can't say enough about people like that. Because somebody new comes in, everyone knows what it's like to be new at a company. The guy that first welcomes you, the one who first makes you part of the fraternity, is somebody that's always a special person. And Glenn McDonald was an outstanding producer for many years at the Score, was a big influence on me and so many others. We'd lost touch over the years, but I got word a couple months ago that he'd been diagnosed with cancer. And I heard it was bad. It's stage 4. I'm like, oh man, that's horrible. So I got his number, left a message, didn't hear back. Was talking with some mutual friends. They said, no, it's bad. It's stage 4 pancreatic. It's already spread. And I was like, oh my God. And I said, you know, I left a message. Said, yeah. And I said, honestly, at this point, your best bet is to write a letter. And hopefully they'll get to Glennie, and his daughter or wife will be able to read it to you, because he's not on his phone. At this point, he's just trying to be as comfortable as possible. So I believe from time of diagnosis to his passing was 2 months.
Oof.
Just terrible, terrible news. So they had a wake in Scarborough last week. A bunch of all my old buddies from the Score were able to be there. So obviously I was not there. But I've been thinking about Glennie a lot, because he was, as I am, a gigantic Akira Kurosawa fan. And Kurosawa's birthday was last Sunday, the great Japanese filmmaker. And I remember when Glennie was leaving the Score, because he went to a different job, I gave him a card, and I also gave him this movie Akira, which we're about to discuss. And after we were talking on the phone, he's like, oh, buddy, thank you so much. I'm like, dude, Akira is such a great film. He said, no, forget about the movie. He goes, the card was so great. It was so genuine. It was so sweet. I said, no. But his favorite Kurosawa movie is The Seven Samurai, which for many people is Kurosawa's best film. It's absolute landmark. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. And Kurosawa in general is a hugely influential filmmaker on American audiences. You know, some filmmakers are great in their home country. They don't translate as well. Spielberg's favorite movie, I believe, is Akira. Seven Samurai is a big influence on Coppola. The Hidden Fortress, George Lucas said, was an influence for Star Wars. And I can't remember now. I'd have to go back and watch The Hidden Fortress, but there's definitely characters you're like, oh, that's like C-3PO. That's R2-D2. Like, it's that much that he's mirroring. And Lucas has always made it clear. No, listen, I'm cribbing from Kurosawa. And, of course, my boy Marty, he loves a couple of his movies, one called The Bad Sleep Well, which is a great movie, and High and Low. High and Low is in the news right now because Denzel Washington and Spike Lee just announced that they're going to remake Kurosawa's film High and Low. And I believe Jeffrey Wright is also going to be in the movie as well. So listen, he's a filmmaker who's been dead for years, but his movies are still obviously very powerful and transcendent and are really making an impact everywhere. So the story of Akira, I just want to tell you briefly about, is about a guy who is diagnosed with stomach cancer, which is now ironic that I'm talking about Glennie, because he's diagnosed with stomach cancer and he's told that he doesn't have much time to live. And one aspect of the film, which puzzled many Western viewers, is the question of why the doctors, the film's protagonist, the civil servant played by Watanabe, played by Takashi Shimizu, decide not to inform he is suffering from terminal cancer, though he has inadvertently discussed the truth and has let his doctors know that he knows. But in the audio commentary of the film on the Criterion home video release, which of course I have, again, you check it on Criterion, Akira Kurosawa scholar Stephen Prince, this guy's brilliant, by the way, reveals that the decision reflects Japanese medical practice at the time. In the early 1950s, a diagnosis of stomach cancer was regarded as a virtual death sentence. It was feared that to reveal the truth to the patient would only aggravate the disease. As late as the 1980s, Prince states, Japanese medical journals were still debating the wisdom of this practice of medical non-disclosure. So a Japanese audience would not have found the doctor's behavior even unusual. Think about that, Cody. In today's age, you go and you ask your doctor for a diagnosis. Like, yeah, might be cancer. We're not totally sure, though. We'll figure it out. And he knows that you have terminal cancer. I remember watching the film thinking that was like beside myself that you couldn't announce it. But apparently, that's part of Japanese practice. I don't know about you, but if I'm the type, give it to me straight. If I'm going to die, doc, give it to me straight. Let's not beat around the bush.
Not worried about the disease freaking out when it hears the news.
Exactly. Just let it go. So the story of Akira, which, by the way, is translated to live, is about this guy, a civil servant, who finds out he only has so much time to live. And what is he going to do with his life the rest of the way? And it's a beautiful story. I don't want to say too much about it because I want people to actually watch the film. There's this great moment where the character sings. Now, Toshirô Mifune was the lead actor, was always in Kurosawa movies. He's actually not in Akira. He's like how De Niro's always in Scorsese movies. But Mifune is not in this movie. He's in Ron. He's in Rashomon. But Takashi Shimura is the main actor. So he sings a song called Song of the Gondola. Director Akira Kurosawa instructed him to sing the song as if you are a stranger in a world where nobody believes you exist. Kurosawa himself considered the film his greatest work. The song, which is sung by Kenji Watanabe in the bar, is called Gondola no Uta, which is the gondola song. The script, by the way, partly inspired by Tolstoy's novella, The Death of Ivan Illich. The major themes of the film, including learning how to live, the inefficiency of bureaucracy, and decaying family life in Japan. Again, the literal translation of Akira is to live. The script's original title, which translates to The Life of Kenji Watanabe, that was changed after Kurosawa's suggestion. He also found it a little bit pretentious. Hideo Oguni, one of the three main writers, originally envisioned Takashi Shimura's character as being a yakuza, that's a gangster, as opposed to a government bureaucrat. This is said to be Steven Spielberg's favorite film. An American remake was announced in 2003 by his company DreamWorks, which would have starred Tom Hanks, been written by Richard Price, who I love. He wrote Clockers, brilliant, brilliant writer, and directed by Jim Sheridan. He did In the Name of the Father. But it was never produced. An English language movie, Living, did end up getting made, separate British production. Came out last year. I wasn't crazy about it, Bill Nye. It's really tough to topic hero. It's included among Roger Ebert's greatest movies list. And the first collaboration between Hideo Oguni and director Akira Kurosawa. The two would also work together on numerous subsequent films, such as Seven Samurai, Throne of Blood, The Hidden Fortress, Sanjuro, High and Low, which I mentioned, that's a Spike Lee, Denzel Washington film, it's being redone, Tedesco Den, and also Ron, which came out in 1985. Ron is his version of King Lear. The film has a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It is ranked number 72 non-English-speaking film in the critics poll conducted by the BBC in 2008. The film is part of the Criterion Collection. It is included included among the 100 movies you must see before you die, edited by Steven Schneider, and the film is in the official top 250 narrative feature films on Letterboxd. Again, Kurosawa said he wanted to make a film about a man who knows he's going to die and who wants a reason to live for a short time, a man who is set to die in 75 days, and that the character himself was less important. That's widely why it's a government bureaucrat. The questions he raises with this film and the tender universal answers that he came up with are given another startling dimension when one considers that under severe distress in his personal life, Kurosawa himself attempted suicide back in December of 1971. Again, the story of Ikiru is one that I think is universal and heartfelt. It's about a guy finding out he does not have much time to live and then tries to make the most of his life. There's a very, very famous shot, which is the cover of the movie, which is of the main character Shimura on a swing set, and it's snowing. Oftentimes in the movie, there's rain. But when Kurosawa wants a really important film, he has the snow start falling down. It's a gorgeous shot. It's one of my favorite shots in motion pictures. The first time the camera starts tracking and you see him on that swing set at the end, it's absolutely amazing. And the ending is, it's just heartbreaking as you see a man trying to make some sense of his life. It's rare that I would say a movie is genuinely life-affirming, but I think Akira is. It's one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. I mentioned it's Spielberg's favorite movie of all time. Anytime you see a movie and say, I feel like my life has been changed, I think that's a pretty remarkable achievement, and I felt that way the first time I see Akira, and whenever I end up watching it, I still feel moved by it. And as I said, I'm doing it with a heavy heart, particularly for my buddy Glennie Mack, who again passed away very tragically at the age of 52. It's still tough to believe he's no longer with us. His daughter's only 16 years of age. We put up some money towards her and college fund and all the rest of it, but my thoughts to his wife Andrea, his daughter Kate, what they all must be going through. But Glennie Mack was a beautiful guy, wonderful, original, funny, great laugh, huge Red Wings fan, and he loved Akira Kurosawa. We definitely had that bond in common. R.I.P. to my buddy Glennie Mack and R.I.P. to the great Kurosawa. Make sure you check out Akira, available on Criterion. Time now for Double Indemnity. What's better than one author? How about two? Enjoy. From the moment they met, it was murder, Double Indemnity, and the rise of film noir, a terrific new book, which is available April 2nd, wherever you get your books. Alain Silver and James Ursini are the authors. A pleasure to discuss it with them. And honestly, I'll start with you, James. This is such a fantastic book, and it's a more reason to really enjoy the movie, which is, you know, essential film noir. I'll start with this. This is page 163. I believe you're quoting from this essay, What is This Thing Called Noir, from Linda Brookover. One of the enduring ironies of Double Indemnity, which is arguably one of the most important noir films of the classic period, is the casting of its principals. In a credit block of stars that included Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck, and Edward G. Robinson, how many viewers not already familiar with the plot from James N. Cain's novel would have expected the star of Little Caesar to be only the good guy? The tough-talking, sometimes shady characters portrayed by Barbara Stanwyck were not exactly shrinking violets, but compared to Phyllis Dietrichson, they were choir girls. And long before portraying the craven second mate in the Caine Mutiny, Fred McBrain was more likely to be treating jibes with Claudette Colbert than tossing bodies on train tracks. So let's start with the casting first. My favorite element of it all is Edward G. Robinson. He's just so fabulous as Keyes, and yet as that excerpt there points out, he's the good guy when normally you thought him as this gangster.
Yeah, Robinson at that point was sort of in his mid-career and wasn't quite as famous as he had been during the Warner Brothers period when he was playing gangsters. He also didn't just play gangsters. He also did biographical films like the Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet. So he had a variety, but he was known for obviously Little Caesar and all the different films that he made during that period. But yeah, he loved doing this part. As a matter of fact, he asked Kane to write another script after the movie came out. It was so successful for him, particularly taking the Keyes character and carrying it forward. And he liked the challenge of playing someone who had these levels of depth, you know, could be vicious and could be like he does when he sort of attacks the truck driver at the beginning, who's cheating on his claim. He could be vicious if he wanted to be, but had this sort of very strange love affair. And that's what Billy Wilder called it, the director, a love affair with his employee. And that was something that really appealed to him. And of course, he was known for being like perfect in terms of his delivery, and in terms of he inspired the other actors to just be as perfect, because Fred McMurray was known for flubbing lines often. So he sort of tried to live up to Edward G. Robinson's level. And same thing with Barbara Stanwyck. So it actually revitalized his career because of the Academy Award nominations for the film, and it was so successful critically. That he began to immediately went into making more noirs with director Fritz Lang, like Scarlet Street and Woman in the Window, and made a really wonderful gangster film later on with John Huston called Key Largo with Humphrey Bogart. Mm-hmm. So he continued, yep. And it's, as I said, it revitalized his career until he was graylisted in the 50s because of his background supporting anti-fascist movements during the Second World War and sort of leftist movements. And he was sort of, they called graylisting, it's more blacklisting because he wasn't officially on a blacklist, but he had a difficult time finding work in the 50s because of the accusations that he, you know, that were leveled at so many people in Hollywood that they were connected with Communist Party when in fact they were just anti-fascist and sort of New Deal liberals. It was something that, as I said, he really admired the script, admired the book, and wanted to even continue doing that character in another book.
I was about to say, he's so memorable in the movie, which is what makes it so special. I love this part, too. Keyes is dyspeptic about life. The cause, as always, is his little man. He came close to marriage once to an unnamed fiance, but his nephew decides she was a tramp from a long line of tramps. Where does that come from? The whole concept of, you know how I know? My little man tells me.
Yeah, that's something that that Chandler and Wilder came up with. Kane wasn't really involved with the writing of the script himself, James M. Kane, who wrote the original novel. But this concept of the little man is a really sort of brilliant piece that helped, you know, give him that sense of drive, and also clued the audience into when the plot, when the things were moving along, and whether the plot would, it seems so, how does he know that this is happening? Why does he feel this way? And so they sort of personified it in this concept of a little man who tells him what's right. I think that's Alan, the phone there is Alan.
Yep.
Yeah, Alan, if you can just speak to that a little bit further about Little Man and Keyes and Edward G. Robinson, the genesis of that?
Well, I missed the opening question, by the way. I'm sorry to be late, but my phone still says in the waiting room, my cell phone. So my Zoom isn't working.
You're here, man.
Yeah, we can hear you. All good. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll do it this way then. You know, the little man concept, I think, has a variety of meanings. There's a lot of sexual innuendo in Double Indemnity. And we comment in the book briefly how the Neff character is sort of led by his own little man. And there's a counterpoint in terms of Keyes, who actually devised it in terms of Chandler. Wilder really isn't clear. But the workings within the movie, I think, are quite effective.
Yeah, Alan, I love the movies of Paul Schrader. Of course, he famously was a film critic long before he, you know, became the celebrated screenwriter and director. There's this one excerpt you guys have. In that same year, this 1972, Paul Schrader wrote effusively, Double Indemnity was the first film which played film noir for what it essentially was, small-time, unredeemed, unheroic. The Wilder Chandler Double Indemnity provided a bridge to the post-war phase of film noir. The unflinching noir vision of Double Indemnity came as a shock in 1944. 3 years later, however, Double Indemnities were dropping off the studio assembly line. Alan, can you speak to just its influence, especially in the immediate aftermath?
Well, I think, you know, in the context of the movement, it took a while for the concept to be established. I think what's obvious to people looking back is it's not like this movement had a name. It really didn't get a name for a while, but it did have a consciousness. And in terms of filmmakers understanding what was beginning in the 40s and participating in it. I think you have several breakthroughs in Double Indemnity. Most notable, it's not that the characters are criminals. It's that the audience is encouraged to sympathize with them. I think we comment in the book about the famous scene where the car won't start and how it's a sort of ultimate manipulation that you can do in a movie. And what you're doing is getting the audience to hope that these characters escape, get away with their crime. Well, obviously, if they can't leave where they've dumped the body on the track, they're ultimately going to be caught, or they'll walk away, but their vehicle will be discovered. That's, I think, one of the most important aspects of the noir movement. It's characters who are not idealized. In fact, many of them are craven. Nonetheless, the audience is encouraged to empathize with them, to hope that they succeed. And the irony of Double Indemnity, of course, is that you know from the beginning, I mean, it's not that many minutes into his recording of his confession that Neff explains what happened. You know what's going to happen, but in the moment, at every juncture, you're encouraged to empathize with Neff and Phyllis. And I think that sensibility is what helped define the noir movement.
Yeah, and also I think that the success, the Academy Award nominations, the success within the industry, allowed for it freed up the movie industry in Hollywood to do. For instance, Kane, this book was being kicked around Hollywood for a while, the original Double Indemnity, since it was published in the mid 30s, and it was the censor for Hollywood at that point was Joe Breen, who was the Motion Picture Association had to approve the films in order for them to get the seal, which allowed them to be shown in movie theaters. So what this did, because it was so successful, is that it freed that up so that, for instance, Kane's other novels could be adapted, like Postman Always Drinks Twice and Mildred Pierce and so forth. And so that's how it sort of created the noir movement in a way, because it allowed for the censors sort of backed off. They saw that these were successful. The studios were not going to be as amenable to listening to what they said in terms of what things they could do and what not could do. So it just blossomed after that, you know. And it also was the times, you know, the Second World War, the post-war period, where there was a lot of disruption, a lot of darkness in terms of the war, in terms of recovery after. So audiences seemed to be more open to these kinds of characters. And again, as I said before, as was Wilder said, the reason that someone would identify with these people is because they're trying to achieve the American dream, right? She's in an oppressive relationship with an older man. He's wants to beat the system because he's tired of working for this, you know, basically exploitative insurance company, which most insurance companies are one way or the other. And they both want the system to beat the system, you know, her to find to get the money that she wants that she can't get through any other way, or she sees as not being able to get through, and him through his ability or his desire to defeat the father, which is Keys, to defeat the system, and everybody, there's that desire to beat the system, you know, to become successful. And maybe you're willing to take some sort of shady methods in doing that. So I think that appealed to people, particularly, as I said, in this sort of dark period that occurred during the war and after the war.
Yeah, who exactly is cheering for an insurance company? It's a good point. From the moment they met, it was murder. Double Indemnity, the rise of film noir. We're talking with Alan Silver and James Rossini. I love this blurb here as well. Wilder also knew that imposing a style need not be a conscious act. As he told Bob Porfirio about film noir, I do not imagine Monet painting the landscapes and telling himself, now, wait a minute, I'm an impressionist, therefore I must do it this way. He didn't think. He painted. If you have any kind of style, the discerning ones will detect it. Call it a thriller, call it a psychological or tough melodrama, call it crime film, call it film noir. Whether or not they had a consensus term for it yet, filmmakers of the classic period knew what it was. Alan, having said that, what kind of movies did Billy Wilder make? Because it seemed like he transcended every genre.
Well, obviously, Wilder's own career follows, I guess, two different arcs. The very serious movies, Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, Lost Weekend, epitomizing those. And then, yeah, a transition somewhat keyed to his ending the collaboration, a longtime collaboration with Charles Brackett, which, as readers of the book know and watchers of the movie know, was interrupted only by Double Indemnity, Brackett not wanting to work on the movie, and Chandler taking his place, segues to I.A.L. Diamond. But the sensibility remains the same. It's just the cynical view of American society, people caught up, as James noted, in their middle-class dreams, is still the focus. So you can see a link from Double Indemnity to Fortune Cookie. It's just a different context from a film noir drama to a Wilder comedy, but essentially the message is the same. You know, the characters in Fortune Cookie are also trying to game the insurance system, just from a slightly different perspective. So I don't really think Wilder's sensibility changed. Obviously, his outlook is always keyed to the same view of society, and I think that's what distinguishes his movies from a lot of other Hollywood product. You know, the projects he chose within the system are, you know, a little bit less standard and a little bit more focused on societal issues.
Yeah, I mean, even in something like Some Like It Hot, which is probably his among his most famous films, there's a darkness to that which is draws a straight line back to the film noirs. His comedies were extremely cynical and extremely abrasive. You know, he had things he wanted to attack, things in the American dream that were he believed obstructions to people reaching that dream. And so you see it even in films like, or you see The Apartment, for instance, which Fred McMurray is in again, where it's also very cynical. It's mostly a comedy, but a very cynical take on business life. Right.
Yeah, it's amazing to think of his range in Wilder. A couple more for you, we'll let you go. James, what did you think of Body Heat, the remake by Larry Kasdan, which is obviously inspired by Double Indemnity?
Well, I think it's a great film. He might have actually tried to credit Double Indemnity at some point, you know, at least in the credits, you know, because it is really a steal of it. But it's a very obviously modern take. He could do things that Wilder only could wish he could do in 1944. You know, he's able to show the sexuality of the characters on a more visceral level, as opposed to the sort of fade away, you know, in the apartment, knowing that they had sex, or the interplay of the dialogue. Though that has its charm, you know, the famous interplay where he first meets, where Neff first meets Phyllis, and they do the interplay about the speed limit and the cops catching her, and all has to do with sex and sexuality. It's more tantalizing in a way. So what Kasdan did, because it was the 1980s, is that he made everything more upfront in terms of what he could deliver on in terms of the sexuality. But the other interesting difference is the ending. In Kasdan's film, the femme fatale gets away. You could never do that, or very rarely do that in the 1940s. Again, because of the production code, because of people like Joseph Breen, who ran the production code, as we talked about. But in 1980s, you could. You know, she's seen on a beach. He's back in jail. She's gotten away with everything. And that would happen more and more often in films because of the strength of the feminist movement at that period. Would happen more and more in films, which is something, you know, would Wilder and Chandler have been interested in doing that in back in 1944, even if they could, maybe not. But so Kasdan plays with the characters and the plot, but he hews to it pretty closely, and it's a wonderful movie.
Alan, your thoughts on Body Heat?
Well, you know, I think the dynamic that you see in Body Heat is essentially a replication of Double Indemnity. But I think what's interesting, you don't have the softening that you do at the end. I mean, inexplicably, at the end of Double Indemnity, and I presume spoilers are allowed here, Phyllis chooses not to finish Neff off. She gives him a little speech about why, and he doesn't buy it and shoots her. You have a semi-reversal of that, but you have the same concept being carried through. You know, who knows what Phyllis is really thinking at the beginning when she enmeshes Walter. Clearly at the end, she's trying to figure out a way to pin it all on him. You're never really clear about what she's doing with Nino Zucchetti and what she's trying to accomplish there. Because you're in Neff's point of view, he has an opening into... He has a possible escape, pinning it on at Phyllis and Zucchetti. He just can't see it through. You know, I mean, after he shoots her, he tells Zucchetti to leave, go call Lola, and drives back to his office and dictates his confession. So clearly, 30-plus years down the line... you had an opportunity in Body Heat to continue the line of conspiracy that first put forth in Double Indemnity. No one escapes. They do have to both ride to the end of the line. But in Body Heat, Maddie can get off. Not finish that ride and end up on a beach, although a lot of people have argued that she doesn't really seem all that thrilled in the last shot on the beach.
Yeah,
maybe there was a fly in her drink, who knows.
Double Indemnity and the Rise of Film Noir by Alan Silver and James Rossini. From the moment they met, it was murder. Fabulous book, gentlemen. Thanks so much for the time, and hopefully people will love this book and love the movie. And on a personal note, Double Indemnity was one of my favorites, but Out of the Past might be my favorite film noir. So my goal to both of you is to write a book about Out of the Past. I love Mitchum so much. What do you say,
James?
Well,
I did the DVD commentary for it. So if you get the DVD, you can listen to my commentary. But yeah, Out of the Past is one of the great films of film noir.
I definitely have the DVD, so now I will go listen to the commentary. That's fantastic. Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
So we're recording this on April Fool's Day. By the way, thanks once again to James and Alan. Those guys were great. Before we start recording, Cody said to me, hey, the Dolphins signed Tua. And I said, before you tell me, give me the number. I said, 5 years, 200. He goes, 5 years, 280. More than Mahomes, more than all these guys. And oh, my God. And now we are being told.
It's an April Fool's joke. Apparently, I just looked at that tweet I saw, and it was like Tyreek ESPN. It wasn't actually ESPN, but I don't feel good about this. But
this race is,
it makes me feel better because I thought that would be like, I think that he's going to slot in that like 40. 60 year,
yes,
mid, like not like top tier, but not the top. Yeah. So I'm happy now. I'm happy.
We don't want Kirk Cousins disease, where all of a sudden this guy's the highest paid player in the sport. I go, how did this happen? They go, well, the cap of no. Yeah. Like Tua's great. He's elite, but he shouldn't be right there.
Right.
That raises the better question of April Fool's Day, which we're recording on today. I know everyone will be listening to this tomorrow, but where are you at on April Fool's Day? Because my belief is this: I think it's fine when you're younger. I'm all up for a good prank, good joke. When you get to a certain age, yourself, 35, 36, 37, you go, no more April Fool's jokes. Like
I mean, it has to be good though. Like the most, like, I don't know, like that one was just realistic enough that it got me. Like a lot of times it's like some Denzel Washington is retiring from acting. It's like, oh, yeah. Or Jackie Chan passed away.
Well, here's the thing. So when does a joke, like, and I'll boot specifically the shipping container. So if it's something involving Tony, which was non-life-threatening, and it's just like, whatever, he broke his leg, he can't come in tomorrow, like, you gotta cover for his shift. It's ridiculous. Versus someone goes, hey, dude, Levitra had a heart attack. Like, at what point is it no longer?
Right. Funny? At what point are you just an asshole? Right. Mike and I were joking on the show on Monday that we should if you really want to trick people, make up a new April Fool. Like, but it's not April. Like, make a September Fool's Day, and then just start saying shit to people, and they'll have no idea that it's September Fool's Day. And
right,
then you can really get people.
Right, April 1st, everyone's on guard. Like, whatever. Like, I'm wary right out of the gate.
I was weird all morning, all day on Twitter. I'm like, I'm not falling for anything. And then Tua got me. I let my guard down. We were about to start the podcast. I let my guard down, and it got me.
Then you got burned.
I put it in a group chat. I put it in my Dolphins group chat, and they're like, yeah, you idiot. Check the tweet. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
If it was just between you and me, it would have been fine. The fact it's in a group chat, now I feel free. That sucks when you get burned and people know there's egg on your face. One other thought on Double Indemnity, because I read the book before the interview, which we taped last week, when I watched the movie. This is the 80th anniversary of Double Indemnity. I know what you're thinking to yourself right now. You're going, hang on, dude. Like, there's no way this movie holds up. What I still enjoy about this movie, and I don't watch a whole lot of old boys, black white movies, but I love Edward G. Robinson as Keys, because when he talks in the stereotypical way you'd expect him to talk in the 1930s and 40s. So if I should be right, exactly right. The entire movie, it was like, okay, so there's an insurance fraud, eh? Like, but when people do that voice, that's who they're doing. They're doing Edward G. Robinson in Little Caesar, which is when he played a gangster, which is 1931, but also Double Indemnity. So while watching the movie, it's a great movie. You should all read the book. But for the next 3 to 4 hours, wherever I went, whoever I was talking to, I couldn't resist going, see, that's what you're doing, insurance fraud,
Shane,
you know, Chris? My little man tells me. My little man right here inside of me, he tells me.
Have you heard of Shane Gillis?
Yeah, Gillis is great.
He has a hilarious bit on white people were the coolest people and talked like that because they thought they were cool until Jackie Robinson like played baseball and they saw it. You could hear it leave his voice. It's like, this player, he's a new, just Jackie Robinson, best player that you've seen. And then he hits a home run and he's just like, oh, God.
Our moment's over being cool. Like,
obviously, he does it way better than me, but it's just such a great bit.
It was on Netflix. I saw it over the holidays.
That special is great. It's one of the funniest specials I've seen in a long time.
I agree. Speaking of specials, I got to see Rami Yusuf. His new special just came out March 23rd. I know he did SNL this past week, so I do have to check out. My buddy Cabby was saying it was pretty funny. But you're right, Gillis was great. Gillis, I remember, because I'm like, didn't that guy get hired by SNL? Then he got let go because of whatever previous Asian jokes or things he'd been saying. I'm like, okay. Like, I'm always conflicted on those. I'm like, hey, man, if you went through every single guy's vault of every single inappropriate joke they've made, particularly comedians, like we'd probably find one or two unsavory jokes in every single person. But regardless, SNL made their decision. But now it's worked out for him. Gillis had more puff for getting let go. Now I'm like, he's a legit, really funny. And he went back into SNL earlier this year.
The ultimate win for him.
Yeah, he was like, F SNL. I was always more of a Mad TV guy, but sure, I'll come back and do your show. So it's definitely worked out well for him. Edward G. Robinson. Yeah, see? Make sure you listen to Cinephile. Subscribe right now. Apple Podcast. Subscribe, rate, review. Yeah, Double Indemnity. Great film, huh? You know how I know? My little man knows. One other thought on April Fool's Day, and just in relation to movies, I can't think of a bigger joke in cinema than the fact Billie Eilish has 2 Academy Awards and Martin Scorsese has 1. I cannot
that
think
must
of
hurt you. Joke. That must that, hurt
like,
you.
That, like, I remember before The Departed and Marty won, that was Jon Stewart's joke when 3-6 Mafia won. It was, just to be clear, 3-6 Mafia 1, Martin Scorsese 0. And I remember that was a great joke. Now I'm like, Billie Eilish 2, Marty 1.
The leaderboard, though, it's Billie Eilish and then 3-6 Mafia, and they're tied, right? They have the same?
They're tied with Marty. And that is not an April Fool's joke. Make sure you join us next week on Cinephile. Lots more coming down the pipe. I don't even know what we're doing next week, actually. I was about to tease next week. I have no idea. We'll figure it out, though. Baseball's in full swing. Final Four. Enjoy yourselves. Go to Apple Podcasts. Subscribe, rate, review. And I'll see you next time.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.